Matthew chapter 9, starting at verse 27. It says, when Jesus departed from there, two blind men followed him, crying out and saying, Son of David, have mercy on us. And when he had come into the house, the blind men came to him, and Jesus said to them, do you believe that I am able to do this? They said to him, yes, Lord. Then he touched their eyes, saying, according to your faith, let it be to you. And their eyes were opened, and Jesus sternly warned them, saying, see that no one knows it. But when they had departed, they spread the news about him in all that country. As they went out, behold, they brought to him a man mute and demon-possessed. And when the demon was cast out, the mute spoke, and the multitudes marveled, saying, It was never seen like this in Israel. But the Pharisees said, he casts out demons by the ruler of the demons. Then Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every sickness and every disease among the people. But when he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion on them, because they were weary and scattered like sheep having no shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, the harvest truly is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest. This final section of Matthew 9 serves as a transition to a new focus in Matthew's book. He began at the beginning of his gospel by asserting Jesus' lineage and history in the genealogy. Then he moved on to Jesus' authoritative teaching in the Sermon on the Mount. Then the ministry of Jesus continued as he moved among the cities and villages in Galilee, healing the sick, raising the dead, confronting the religious leaders. While I would argue that every record of Jesus performing a miracle like healing, everyone is there to teach us more than just Jesus can heal. There's always some other underlying truth that's confirmed in those accounts. And that is maybe no more clear than it is when it gets to this section of Matthew 9. In verses 27 through 31, Jesus gives sight to two blind men, proving he is the Son of David and confirming the importance of faith in him. In verses 32 through 34, Jesus heals a mute man, casting out a demon from him, confirming his power over the devil, even as the Pharisees accuse him of being in league with the devil. In verses 35 through 38, Jesus heals all kinds of sickness and disease as a display of his compassionate nature, proving he is the good and caring shepherd of our souls. It seems Matthew has put these stories of healing here not to just prove that Jesus can heal, although he can, but to confirm some other important facts about Jesus before he moves on with the story of Jesus' ministry in chapter 10. So we're going to dig into this and see what it has to teach us, but let me give you the takeaway sentence right now. If we were going to learn something in a nutshell, it is this. We are to declare the gospel of Jesus Christ to the world because we know with complete confidence he is the promised Messiah. We are to declare the gospel of Jesus Christ to the world because we know with complete confidence he is the promised Messiah. Three parts here. Healing the blind men proved Jesus is the Son of David. Verse 27, Jesus departed from there. Two blind men followed him, crying out and saying, "Son of David, have mercy on us." And when he had come into the house, the blind men came to him, and Jesus said to them, "Do you believe that I am able to do this?" They said to him, "Yes, Lord." Then he touched their eyes, saying, "According to your faith, let it be to you." If you are at all familiar with Matthew's gospel, you'll know that this story seems very similar to another account of healing that we won't actually encounter until we get to chapter 20. The end of chapter 20 is a long way down the road, but entering the final week of his ministry, Jesus passes through Jericho. He calls Zacchaeus down from a tree, and then he continues to the outside of the city where he encounters, Matthew tells us, two blind men who are crying out, "Son of David, have mercy on us." We even know the name of one of them is Bartimaeus, although that means son of Timaeus, so maybe we don't really know his name. But these two men in Matthew 9, these are different guys on a different day in a different place. But they make an identical claim. In verse 27, they call out, "Son of David, have mercy on us." What I want you to ask yourself at this point is, why is that what they call out? Why aren't they calling out Jesus of Nazareth or famous rabbi? Why do they call him Son of David? They did not have the opportunity to read Matthew's genealogy starting back in chapter 1. It hadn't been written yet. But they had heard of the ministry of Jesus. Obviously, they hadn't seen it, but they had heard of the ministry of Jesus. They had heard where he came from, what he had done, how he had taught. And as a result, they came to a conclusion that no one else seems to have made at this point. It is exactly the conclusion that Matthew hopes his readers will have made by this point in the gospel account. Jesus is the Son of David. Matthew was not at all subtle about front-loading that expectation into his gospel account. Matthew chapter 1, verse 1 begins by saying, "This is the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham." So from verse 1, Matthew has been saying, here's what you should learn. As much as I try to give you a takeaway sentence in most messages, here's what we're going to see. Matthew does that right up front. He says, here's your takeaway from this gospel story. From the start, Jesus is the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. To prove that requires more than simply proving that Jesus has descended from David. You know, King David is hanging out on a limb up there in Jesus' family tree somewhere. There are surely at this point hundreds of thousands of people who could say that they have descended from King David in one way or another. But there is only one promised son of David who has the right and the power to take up that title and apply it to himself. And Jesus is that son of David. This title refers back to a promise of God to King David in 2 Samuel chapter 7. In that story, King David decided that he was going to build a temple. He says, "I want to build a house for the Lord." And God responds to him simply through the prophet Nathan by saying, "Oh no, that's not how this works. Our relationship is not grounded in what you're going to do for me. It's all in what I've done for you. You're not going to build me a house. I'm going to build you a house." And the promise that follows in 2 Samuel 7 is that God makes this covenant pledge to establish a son of David who would build a house for God's name, who would establish an eternal kingdom, and who would rule on David's throne forever. But of that son of David, God said, I will be his father and he will be my son. So this messianic promise became a foundation for all of Israel's future hope. In Matthew's gospel, he sets out to prove Jesus is that promised Messiah. He is that son of David. But almost 10 chapters in at this point, there is nothing in the text that hints that anyone has gotten that yet. Until Matthew chapter 9, verse 27, two blind men finally see what no one else seems to be able. The world's blind to it, but they don't even need eyes in order to see it clearly. They're shouting out, Son of David, have mercy on us. To which Jesus hears this claim, this statement of faith, and he responds in mercy and compassion by turning around and walking into a house. Verse 27 tells us Jesus leaves from there, right? Probably from Jairus' house where he just raised the Pharisee's 12-year-old daughter from the dead. And these two blind guys are shouting at him out in the streets of Capernaum, yet Jesus seems to want to have a private conversation. Verse 28, his response, it says, is to go into a house. And then the blind men get brought to him, and Jesus quizzes and interacts with them privately. Do you believe I'm able to do this? He asks. Not, are you sure about who I am, but do you have confidence in what I can do? And when they answer, yes, Lord, they feel, according to verse 29, they would feel Jesus touching their eyes. They would hear him speak the words, according to your faith, let it be unto you. This is also a recurring theme in Matthew's gospel, right? The leper who wanted cured, the centurion who wanted his servant healed, Jairus who wanted his daughter raised from the dead, the bleeding woman, they were all expected to explicitly confess their faith in Jesus. And these blind men were also required to express their confidence in him. The work of Jesus is not just about coming to fix your problems. It's about coming and establishing saving faith in him. Now I want you to just imagine this scene for a moment. Just picture it in your mind. Like some of you have seen those videos online of some new medical technology that would like allow someone who's deaf to be able to hear for the first time. Or even there's glasses that they're making that allow someone who's completely colorblind to actually see colors for the first time. Go watch a few of those things. Not right now, but go watch a few of those things. Make sure you've got some Kleenex first, because if you have any compassion in you at all, you're going to tear up and cry when someone sees colors for the first time, or some toddler just stops and starts laughing and crying at the same time because for the first time they've heard the voice of their mother. These two blind men have faith in Jesus, and he touches their eyes, and when he moves his precious hands out of the way, they can see. And what do they see? Well, they're staring face to face with their Lord and Savior. They've already seen what others could not see, that Jesus is the Son of David, and now their faith literally is made sight when they can finally see what everybody else can, and what could they possibly want to see more than Jesus. But this is where it gets complicated. Look at verse 30. And their eyes were opened, and Jesus sternly warned them, saying, see that no one knows it. And when they had departed, they spread the news about him in all that country. This is what is often referred to as a messianic secret passage in the Gospels. It's one of those numerous places very early in Jesus' ministry when the Lord issues what seems like a counterintuitive command to us, right? To keep quiet about Him. Don't go telling people. For example, right after the Sermon on the Mount, when a leper came to Jesus for healing, what He told that leper is, see that you tell no one about it, but just go and show yourself to the priests like Moses commands. When Jesus commands silence like this, it is evident it's because He was not attempting to create some kind of spectacle with the healing, but He was coming in order instead to teach and preach and command repentance and faith in Him. Every time He performed a miracle, it's obvious to this point in Matthew's gospel, every time Jesus performed a miracle, more people flocked to Him just to see more miracles. And Jesus did not intend for these miracles to impede the message. So as I picture it, these two blind men receive their sight and probably immediately start shouting and proclaiming praises. I mean, wouldn't it just be natural? But Jesus, like, there is a reason why He went into the house and has this discussion with them privately. Those words in verse 30 that He sternly warned them are more than just a recommendation. Those words, sternly warned, describe a quick display of emotion. Stop it! Keep it to yourselves! Of course, Jesus doesn't expect them to walk out of the house with their eyes closed, tapping their cane on the ground, walking down the street as if they can't see. But He also doesn't want them running outside screaming and drawing attention to the Lord Jesus, who is clearly more concerned about saving faith than He is the unspiritual fascination people had with miracles. But, just like is common in the rest of those messianic secret passages, the command of Jesus gets ignored. They go out and they start spreading the news in verse 31 throughout all that country. Now, if you are an astute listener, you might want to be pushing back a little on what I said was the takeaway sentence earlier. I said we learn from this text that we are to declare the gospel of Jesus to the world because we know with complete confidence He's the promised Messiah. So how could a text with a command to these formerly blind men to stay silent and not go talking to people, how could that prove that we are to go out and declare the gospel? That's a great question. I'm glad you asked. We will get to the answer. Stop being so pushy. Healing the blind men proved that Jesus is the Son of David. The second part of this, healing the mute man, proved Jesus has power over the devil. Verse 32, as they went out, behold, they brought to Him a man mute and demon-possessed. And when the demon was cast out, the mute spoke, and the multitudes marveled, saying, it was never seen like this in Israel. But the Pharisees said, He casts out demons by the ruler of the demons. The word mute here is the Greek word kaphos, and it can actually be translated as either mute, unable to speak, or deaf, unable to hear, or a combination of the two. Those issues do tend to go together. But we know that mute is the issue because when Jesus addresses this problem, it says the mute spoke. And so clearly His inability to speak is the issue here. But why He was mute is what Matthew is interested in. Matthew says the man is mute and demon-possessed. But look at verse 33. When the demon was cast out, the mute spoke, right? The healing of the mute man did not require some physical miracle It was accomplished by the exorcism of the evil spirits. Jesus cast the demon out of the man, and then the man is able to speak. This mirrors an account from Mark's gospel, although it's not the same account, but in Mark chapter 9, a man brings his son to Jesus saying, "My son has a mute spirit, and that spirit also sometimes seizes him and throws him down so that he falls into a fire. He falls into the water. It's trying to destroy him." So, just a few things I want to say here. First, it is very likely that in first century Judea, there are all sorts of common physical issues like epilepsy or like deafness or muteness that were blamed on demons. Second, it is clear that sometimes things like illness and deafness and muteness were symptoms of the underlying problem that was caused by demon possession. Third, we cannot and should not go about assuming that every medical or mental issue that we can't easily explain must be a case of demon possession. We can't say that, nor should we dismiss the possibility that it is. None of that, though, is what Matthew intends for us to take away from this text. He's already told us. Think about how many times he's already told us about Jesus casting out demons, right? You can glance back one chapter to Matthew 8, verse 16. It says they brought to him many who were demon-possessed, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were sick. That kind of miraculous display is also what caused some of the very problems we just talked about. Because Matthew 8, verse 18 says, when Jesus saw the great multitudes about him, he gave a command to depart to the other side, right? It causes this influx of gawkers, and Jesus wants to get away from that. So he is healing the sick and casting out demons because of his compassion and kindness, not because he's trying to collect a crowd. But the crowd is coming anyway. In this case, in our text, verse 33 says the multitudes marveled, saying it was never seen like this in Israel. Like, come on, everybody, you've got to see this. You've never seen anything like this. That is why Matthew is telling us this story here. It can't be to prove, you know, only prove that Jesus can cast out demons, because he's already shown us that in the crowds in Matthew chapter 8. Or when they did leave and went to the opposite shoreline, there were demon-possessed men there that Jesus cast out demons. That has been proven. But when Jesus throws the demon out of this man and sort of hits the unmute button on his remote control, Matthew is telling us this story in order to show us how the crowd reacts to it, how the religious leaders respond to that crowd's reaction, and how they deal with what is implied by Jesus' ability to cast out demons. Listen, verse 34, the Pharisees said, "He casts out demons by the ruler of the demons." The Pharisees are not taking Jesus' growing popularity well. Now, Jesus himself clearly is not seeking crowds of gawkers to come and watch his ministry. He wants to preach the message and instill repentance and faith. But these people are coming, and more people are coming. And the Pharisees see this, and they are frustrated with it. Matthew introduces this story here in order to show the kind of attention and polarization that gets caused by everything Jesus says and does. Right? This is a transition point in Matthew's story. Jesus is about to send out 12 of his disciples to teach and to preach and to cast out demons and to heal. But right here, we get a sneak preview by Matthew of what to expect when this happens. Let me show you. In this morning's text so far, we have seen blindness and muteness and demon possession, a claim that Jesus is the Son of David, and the Pharisees claiming, well, he's just casting out demons by the ruler of the demons. Okay? Now, look at this with me, Matthew chapter 12. Just go over a couple of chapters. Matthew chapter 12, we'll start reading at verse 22. It says, then one was brought to him who was demon-possessed, blind and mute. And he healed him so that the blind and mute man both spoke and saw. And all the multitudes were amazed and said, could this be the Son of David? Now when the Pharisees heard it, they said, this fellow does not cast out demons except by Beelzebub, the ruler of the demons. And so you have blindness and muteness and demon possession and a claim about Jesus being the Son of David, and the Pharisees reacting by saying he's in league with Satan. Right? That's quite a coincidence, right? Well, we'll deal with chapter 12 when we get there in a few years. But for now, you should know that Jesus addresses the Pharisees' wicked claims by saying a kingdom that is divided against itself cannot stand. Satan does not cast out Satan. I'm casting out demons by the Spirit of God, and you are either with me or against me. And so here in Matthew 9, this is, again, it's a transitional text. Matthew is saying, here's what's coming. People are starting to see who Jesus is. This is going to drive a major wedge between the ones who are with him and the ones who are against him. Jesus healing this mute man proves that he has power over the devil. But there's going to be those who deny that anyway and say he's in league with the devil. Which side are you on? You might as well decide right now before we even get there. The third part of this text, healing the crowds, proved Jesus is the good shepherd. If healing the blind man proved he's the Son of David, and healing this mute man proved he has power over Satan, and healing the crowds proved Jesus is the good shepherd. Before we look at verses 35 through 38, I want you to glance back at something, Matthew chapter 4. Look back at Matthew chapter 4 with me for just a second. Immediately after the baptism of Jesus and his temptation by Satan, Matthew begins this whole section of Jesus' ministry in Galilee with these words. Matthew chapter 4, verse 23. And Jesus went about all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing all kinds of sickness and all kinds of diseases among the people. Okay, ready? Go back to our text now. Matthew chapter 9, verse 35. Then Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every sickness and every disease among the people. Matthew has sort of bookended this section which talks about Jesus' ministry in Galilee, and it's all sort of sandwiched between these virtually identical statements. Jesus sees the crowd, he heals, he cures, he raises the dead, he casts out demons, he teaches and preaches the gospel of the kingdom. But now Matthew tells us why. Look at verse 36. When he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion for them, because they were weary and scattered like sheep having no shepherd. The reason why Jesus is doing all these things is that he is, Matthew says, moved with compassion. I've talked about this phrase before. You may or may not remember. It comes from one of my very favorite Greek words, splagtonizomai. It just sounds cool, right? It's a word that means an emotional reaction based on the deepest part of you. The closest that we will ever come to this in English is to use words like heartache or heartbreak. But really, that doesn't even get the full idea. Jesus sees the crowds, but he sees the crowds differently than they see themselves. The people flocking to Jesus, they did not come to Jesus and walk around looking exhausted and lost, but Jesus sees them that way. He sees them as, it says, weary and scattered. They're like sheep without a shepherd, because sheep don't really have the type of self-awareness that it takes in order to understand the kind of horrible danger they're in. This is imagery coming straight from the Old Testament prophets. Zechariah 11 complains of the shepherds over God's people who were not really taking care of the flock. And in John 10, Jesus calls those kinds of people hirelings, right? They only care about themselves. The minor prophet Micah promises a shepherd who will feed God's flock and lead God's people. I think Matthew might want us to be thinking about Ezekiel, where God promises this, Ezekiel 34, verses 22 and 23. I will save my flock, and they shall no longer be prey, and I will judge between sheep and sheep. I will establish one shepherd over them, and he shall lead them, my servant David. He shall feed them and be their shepherd. God not only, in the promise to Ezekiel, God not only will make a judgment between sheep and sheep, good sheep and bad sheep, it also says he's going to send David to shepherd them. Remember David? David's dead. He's been dead for a long time by the time this promise comes. But he was that shepherd boy who turned king. This is not about God saying that David himself is going to be reincarnated and come to lead God's people. This is a promise about the son of David, the Messiah, who has come, and he will be the one true shepherd king over God's people. And get this, people need to know that. I understand Jesus told the blind men, see that no one knows it, but this transitional text is showing, Matthew showing us that a new phase is about to begin in this ministry. The quiet keeping has to come to an end. And Matthew connects the compassion of Jesus with the commission of Jesus' disciples to go out and tell people about Jesus. Right? The deep-seated emotion of Jesus for those who are weary and scattered and lost, they need to be lifted up. They need to be gathered in. And that's only going to happen through a declaration of the gospel. So Jesus himself changes from a shepherd metaphor to a farming metaphor. It says the harvest is ready. Go get it. Look at verses 37 and 38. He says to his disciples, the harvest truly is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore pray the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest. And we read that and say, well, I will be content to do that. Right? Don't tell me that I have to go out and proclaim the gospel to people. I'm just going to pray that the Lord will send somebody out to go do that job. And I will be fulfilling the command of Jesus. Well, he does not say this like pray that someone would go witness. He says it preparing them to be the ones who would go out and witness. Matthew chapter 10. Oh, I want to start preaching it now. Matthew chapter 10 opens with Jesus calling 12 of his disciples to him, and he commissions them to go proclaim the gospel. We don't have time to deal with it this morning, but this commission in Matthew 10 is absolutely connected to the Great Commission of Matthew 28. You know the Great Commission, right? In Matthew 28, go into all the world, make disciples of all nations. Well, that starts here. This is what Matthew is leading up to. I like to call Matthew 10 a pre-existing commission. There are parallels for all disciples of Jesus to follow. But the main difference between the commission in Matthew 10 and the one in Matthew 28, the Great Commission, the main difference is the audience. When you think about this, in Matthew chapter 10, there is an entire chapter of Jesus' description of going out and preaching the gospel of the kingdom and what to expect and how you're to encounter opposition and how you're to encounter those who hear you, right? There is this great teaching about the details of what fulfilling that commission looks like. When you get to Matthew 28, have you ever noticed there's like two verses Jesus just says, now go do it to everybody? And he doesn't have to explain in great detail there because he's already explained in great detail in Matthew chapter 10. The difference is the audience, because you can glance down, I guess I am going to kind of preach chapter 10. You can glance down at verses 5 and 6 and see they're commissioned to preach the gospel of the kingdom to the lost sheep of the house of Israel and not to the Gentiles, not to the Samaritans. But when you get to Matthew 28, the commission is go to all the world. Go tell everyone. It takes the same authority and expands it to make disciples of all nations. So that's the answer to your pushy question earlier. How does a text that includes Jesus telling two formerly blind men to be quiet about him mean that we should go out and declare the gospel? Well, that's because this is how Matthew has written this. This is what he's leading up to. Do you know that Jesus is the promised Messiah? Do you believe he's the Son of David who is to come? Do you have faith in him, knowing that he has the power and authority over the devil? Do you get that Jesus is the good shepherd? Then you have to know his compassion. And if you know his compassion, then you understand his commission of the disciples to go out and declare the good news. We are to declare the gospel of Jesus Christ to the world because we know with complete confidence that he is the promised Messiah. He is the shepherd king, the son of David. He is the savior that the lost world needs to know.